and I just hope the dream doesn't come true. I do recommend you to be a speaker at Creef Hydro, because I'm staying in the poshest room I have ever stayed in my life. I have my own private jacuzzi. I'm not sure. Anyway. Anyway, I didn't understand Professor Tom Torrance's lectures very well in New College in the 1960s, when he referred to Einstein, quantum theory, the second law of thermodynamics, and these things. But I was determined that one day I would learn what they were all about. And one of the advantages of being a missionary in Malawi and coming back to Scotland for 6 months leave or furlough is that you don't have much to do in the furlough. Deputation work is not heavy. And so I spent many months of my furlough in Edinburgh University Library getting to grips with this subject and trying to understand what it was all about. And I remember the day that the penny dropped, and it was like a great ray of light shining in. And from there on, I just took a whole new interest in this subject. I don't know how long this is all going to take me, and there are two talks now and later. And I would welcome questions. I'll just have to see how time goes. I'm not even sure where I'm going to break at the end of this talk and start the next one. But here goes. There's going to be three parts. The first part, I'm going to describe four ways of understanding all that there is, what C.S. Lewis calls the whole show. If you're an atheist, then the whole show simply means the material universe. If you're a Christian, then the whole show includes is the material universe and God, the Creator. So there are four ways that I'm going to think of thinking of the whole show. First of all, atheistic materialism. Secondly, deism. Thirdly, pantheism or paganism. Fourthly, the biblical revelation of God and his universe of nature, which he created, preserves and redeems. In the second part, I want to describe something of the revolution in 20th century scientific thought as it relates to our overall understanding of the whole show. This part will be mainly scientific, but theology will appear from time to time. The third part, I want to speak of the relevance of all this to Christian theology, and this will be mainly theological. Two disclaimers, first of all. My son Douglas, that Mr. Stills kindly referred to already, phoned me two nights ago and said, "Please, Dad, do not try to prove theology from science." And he was absolutely right, and that's what I mustn't do in this talk, and I certainly don't intend to do that. But what I want to do is this, to show how there is a wonderful deep harmony between Almighty God, his creation and redemption, as revealed in the Bible, and the revolution in 20th century scientific thought. But this does not mean one is proving God or theology from science, not at all. Just recognizing a wonderful harmony that there is. Nor am I trying to resurrect a natural theology or a general revelation. May we just remind ourselves of what we mean by that. Natural theology holds that knowledge of God is in two parts. Firstly, using our reason, we come to a partial knowledge of God from nature. And this is completed in his revelation to us in Christ. And then there's what we call general revelation. This is the belief that all knowledge of God is through his revelation to us, yet this revelation is in two parts. Firstly, God's revelation of himself in nature, general revelation, and secondly, God's revelation of himself to us in Christ. Now, I don't reject either of these ways of thinking, but there is a theological problem with them both, and it's this. They can seem to remove Christ from creation. and nature. Yet both Old and New Testament reveal to us as Christ, the eternal Logos, the Word of God, as the head of all creation. Without him nothing was made that was made, and in him all things hold together. And the way of knowing God, I believe, is in Christ alone. As we read in Matthew's Gospel, no one knows the Father save the Son, and no one knows the Son save the Father and those whom the Father chooses to draw to him. Irenaeus and other Greek fathers loved this text very much. The only way to approach the Father and know the Father is as a child through the eternal Son in the Spirit. But far from making nature irrelevant to theology, it puts it in its proper place, I believe. Knowledge of nature should inspire us to a humble, childlike, and joyful wonder and adoration as we explore and seek to understand all that God has given us in Christ. God has created the finite universe out of nothing, but in harmony with his infinite being of beauty, glory, light and love, which is expressed to us as eternal Father, Son and Holy Spirit. Four ways of understanding then the whole show. First of all, the atheistic, materialistic view of the whole show. This view is that the material existence is all that there is. Everything can be understood in terms of electrons or other fundamental material units of existence, or other fundamental wave particles. In other words, atheism believes that we can understand the whole universe simply by knowing what the whole universe is made of, what nature is made of. Now, an electron is one of these fundamental wave particles from which everything is made. There are others as well. But for the purpose of this talk, when I use the word electron, I mean also all the other fundamental wave particles which make up all natural existence. Now, the atheist materialist believes that by breaking everything up and understanding what everything is made of, by reducing everything to its constituent parts, you'll be able to come to a full knowledge of reality. This is what we call reductionism. We reduce everything to its constituent parts to understand it completely. The atheist materialist says that the universe is really just a gigantic machine. The parts are all connected together by the laws of physics, which just happen to be what they are. Human life, including the human brain, is simply part of this mechanism. Now, of course, the universe is a wonderful mechanism, but the question is, can it be fully understood in terms of mechanism? The atheist would say yes. And this is what we call a mechanistic view of the natural world. And this is the dominant public philosophy in Britain today. Leslie Newbegin speaks of a dichotomy in British society today between the public world of facts and the private world of values. The public world of facts are those things which are to be accepted by everybody without question as facts. So in a physics lesson, a pupil is taught facts. He's not asked to make up his own mind. But in the private world of values, each individual makes up his own mind about his value system. Some people value Beethoven more than Mozart, others Mozart more than Beethoven. This is a private, subjective matter. Some believe in God and that's helpful for them, that's fine. It's true for them. Others don't. They can live without God. That's fine. It's true for them. So in religious education classes, we must teach no facts about God. We can only ask pupils to think it out themselves and see what is most helpful to them. This means that there can be no publicly agreed religion. It also means there can be no publicly agreed value or ethical system. Each person's morality becomes a purely subjective, private matter. So we hear over and over again through the media such statements as, it is wrong to moralize, or at least it's wrong to moralize in public. But of course, if you think carefully, the statement, it is wrong to moralize, is itself a moralism, and therefore contains an inner contradiction. So though, although many individuals in political life and in the media are Christians, this is their own private value system. The public world of facts is atheistic. In the great ethical questions of the day, as debated in Parliament, in television panel discussions, the will of God, the purpose of human life, is never mentioned. The mechanistic view of the universe is also a deterministic view of the universe. If everything is mechanistic, like a great machine, then there is no freedom, therefore no responsibility, therefore no sin, therefore no guilt. Everything is predetermined by the unyielding laws of nature, including this talk that I am giving and your reaction to it, because these laws of nature also control the workings of our brains. And so in principle, from the origins of the universe, if you knew where every fundamental wave particle was, you could have predicted everything that would happen, including this talk, including the emotions that you are having and I am having as we are engaging together. Now we come to the second way of looking at the whole show, and I loosely call this deism. This also has a mechanistic view of the universe, but acknowledges that there must have been a creator or maker, the supreme engineer, or as the Freemasons say, the architect of the universe, who made it all. But once he had made it, he allowed it to go on in its predetermined way. In this scheme, there is no continuing interaction between God and the universe. Extreme liberal theology has at its root this view of God. He cannot intervene in the world or in our lives without disturbing the very basis of creation. He would have to take a bit of the machine away and put something else in, and that would be to disturb the basis of his creation. So in this scheme of things, there is no room for miracle. God is distant and unknowable. Now, as I will show later, probably not until the second talk, the revolution in 20th century science is moving away from this mechanistic model of the universe. But that doesn't mean that our cause is one. There is another direction that could be followed. And this is the direction of pantheism. That is the belief that everything, animate and inanimate, has a spiritual dimension, and that God is the mere sum total of the spiritual forces within nature. There is no creation or creator. This is really paganism. Now, under this heading of paganism, I do not include Islam, because Islam in my view, is really a gross distortion of the Bible. It really is a grotesque Christian heresy, Islam, so I don't include it under the umbrella term paganism. The great world religion which is pagan, in the sense I'm using it, is Hinduism, where the rivers and the trees and the stones have their own spiritual power. In the Western world, this manifests itself in the occult. So there are spiritual powers in the stars, in magic potions. In the Western world, the occult has taken many different forms. In recent years, it's being brought together under one umbrella called the New Age, which many of you will know about. The New Age movement is becoming very powerful in the Western world, and it really has at its heart this belief that all objects, animate and inanimate, have their own spiritual power. And it uses meditation and hypnotic techniques to get each person to surrender his individuality into the great cosmic divine soup. Because we are all part of God, according to this belief. Now, this is very powerful in the Western world indeed. Not as an organized religion. It's not a threat to us in the same way that Islam is a threat to us, where we see mosques being built all over the country. The New Age movement, which is a form of Hinduism, doesn't organize itself in that way, but it shows itself in such ways as yoga and, as I say, hypnosis and relaxation techniques, not all of which are wrong. But this is where it infiltrates our society and is affecting our whole thinking. You may have noticed that when the Green Party began their political convention a few months ago, they didn't begin with a church service, as the Conservative Party conference do. They began by a time of silence where they were to tune in to the spirit of nature. Did you notice that? That's New Age. I'm not saying what all the Green Parties stand for is wrong. Of course, I wouldn't say that at all. But that's the root of that tuning in to the world, the spirit of nature. And it's pagan, pantheistic. And these people are using some of the modern developments in 20th century science to back up their beliefs. I'll come on to that later. And then there's the biblical revelation. And this is the belief that God created all of nature. He is infinite. Creation is finite. And that there is a continuing interaction between God and nature. He speaks. He loves. He calls to us. He expects an answer. Before him, all nations and peoples and churches and families and individuals will one day give account. And this interaction between God and nature is not just in the form of miracle, but, as the scripture says, he upholds all things by the word of his power. There is freedom in nature. Man especially is free. Therefore, sin really means something. There is such a thing as individual responsibility. Yet, I would say, and you may wish to discuss this, humanity is not merely a collection of separate individuals. There is also such a thing in the Bible, I believe, as corporate humanity, in the form of families, churches, peoples, and nations. I think of this when I hear of some appalling, cruel crime that's been committed in the world. I can have two reactions, and maybe you feel the same. You can feel very angry with the criminal who has done this thing. Or, as well, you can feel sorry and almost feel like saying sorry to God that this is what our humanity has come to. In other words, in that sense, one is identifying oneself with the criminal and the crime and feeling part of it. I think of Jesus being baptized in a baptism of confession of sin in the River Jordan. Now, I'm not sure if I'm right in thinking in this way, but I just wonder if in that baptism of confession of sin, he, as it were, confessed the sins of all the world on our behalf. There, because our confession of our sin is always inadequate. Anyway, in the biblical revelation, we are individually responsible and accountable, yet our sin cannot be separated from Adam. In Adam all die. Similarly, I believe in the New Testament we discover an objective relationship between the humanity of Jesus and his church. I may expand on that later if I have time. Now, the second part we come to now, 20th century science. And first of all, I want to say something about God of the gaps. You know what this is. The idea is God of the gaps is now out of fashion, and rightly so. But let me just explain what it is, or refresh our memories. Science can explain so much. The gaps in our knowledge we explain by reference to God. For example, in the past, man knew about clouds and rain. He knew how they were formed. But he didn't understand how lightning came about. So he said lightning was God's work. But as science advanced, man began to understand what lightning is. Therefore, there was no need for God to fill that gap in our knowledge. And as man's knowledge increased more and more, the gaps in knowledge get smaller and smaller, and the need for God as an explanation, therefore, gets smaller and smaller. Let me think again of this example of lightning that I mentioned. And I refer to it in my little booklet here. Man eventually discovers that lightning is caused by a build-up of electric charge in the clouds, and that lightning is in fact electricity. So we think, well, we now know what lightning is. But then the question comes, but what is electricity? Well, we know the answer to that. Electricity is a flow of electrons. Fine. But then the question comes, well, what is an electron? And the answer that we were given in school physics is an electron is a tiny thing with a negative charge that orbits the nucleus of an atom from which all nature is built. Great. But that, unfortunately, is the wrong answer. Because 20th century science has found that such fundamental building blocks of nature, such as atoms, such as electrons, are not things at all. Now, later I'll explain what I mean when I say something is not a thing. It's not thing at all. It cannot be pictured, even though school physics textbooks try to picture it. Its properties transcend space and time. It is not a material entity at all. And a full explanation of what an electron is takes one beyond nature. And therefore, perhaps, beyond the bounds of natural science. I'll come back to that later. But so as science penetrates ever deeper into what makes the natural world what it is, far from the gaps in our knowledge getting smaller, the mystery gets greater and greater. Now, at these boundaries of scientific inquiry, we come face to face with a mystery which transcends space and time. Two questions that have dominated these frontiers of science are these. What is the universe and how did it begin? What is the reason? Second question, what is the reason for the laws of nature? Or, putting it more simply, what is everything made of? Now, I'll be merging these two questions with their answers together as time goes on. But before I deal with these frontier questions, let's consider what 20th century science has discovered about the sheer complexity of nature at or near these fundamental levels of existence. Complexity is the same thing as order. You put certain things in order in a very complicated way, it can accomplish something. And this leads us to a third frontier question: what is life itself? Now, as some of you may know, the simplest cell of life, whether we're talking about the life of a vegetable, an animal, or a human being, the simplest cell of life is in three major parts. It has a nucleus, which contains nature's own computer. It has an outside, which is nature's own chemical factory. And between the two, there is a communication system connecting the computer to the factory. The factory is called the cytoplasm, which manufactures proteins for the building of that particular form of life. Now, the cytoplasm is a chemical factory that is far more complicated than any chemical factory ever made by mankind. The computer in the center of the nucleus is the DNA, which I'm sure you've all heard of, which is more complicated than any computer ever made by mankind. It's a computer with its own language, as all computers have languages. There are four letters which make up the computer language of the DNA. It contains sentences, instruction, and information. Now, if you were to write out the computer program for the simplest bacterium, writing it out in language, it would take you the length of the whole Bible to write out the program for the simplest cell of life of the bacterium. It would take millions of pages to write out the program for one cell for the human being. Now, the RNA is also a language, and that translates the computer language of the DNA so that the cytoplasm, the chemical factory, can understand it and make its proteins. Now, the DNA and RNA computer languages, nature's own computer languages, are far more complicated and wonderful than any human language. Professor Ambrose of London University has written a book called The Nature and Origin of the Biological World. He's a Christian, though it isn't a Christian book. But I recommend anyone who wants to know something about the sheer wonder of the DNA and the RNA to read that book. It's a textbook on biology. Let me quote a non-Christian mathematician writer who, in his book Gödel, Escher and Bach, he writes this. It's a huge book, about 800 pages, but a marvellous book, but he's not a Christian as far as I know. But he writes about the DNA and the RNA, and this is what he says. I'm just quoting it in my own little booklet. A natural and fundamental question to ask on learning of these incredibly, intricately interlocking pieces of software and hardware, he's talking about the simplest cell of life, is how did they ever get started in the first place? It is a truly baffling thing. There are various theories on the origin of life. They all run aground on this most central of all central questions. How did the genetic code, along with all the mechanisms for its translation, originate? As human technology advances down the years, we make our wonderful computers smaller and smaller. One computer used to be as big as a building when they were first made, now they're as big as a watch or smaller. Nature's computer of life is all contained within a fraction of a cubic millimeter and is far more complicated than any human computer. There is another difference. Chemical factories and their computers tend to be ugly. The DNA in the simplest cell of life is beautiful. Now let me say something about the electron and other wave particles from which all of nature, animate and inanimate, is built. They are at least, these electrons, waves of information. Now information means at least language and codes. Who wrote the language? We're talking about nature at its fundamental levels. Now we all know that in obvious ways nature is very ordered. Planets go round the sun, blood flows in our bodies, our eyes, our ears are very complex. We are fearfully and wonderfully made, as David knew. But what 20th century science has discovered is that at the fundamental levels of existence, nature is even more ordered or complex than this. Where did this order come from? Now you may have heard of the second law of thermodynamics, which all children know, and here it goes. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall, Humpty Dumpty had a great fall, all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. That's the second law of thermodynamics. In other words, things go easily from a state of order. A beautiful egg, it's easy to smash an egg, but you try putting it back together again. Second law of thermodynamics says that things move from a state of order to chaos easily. They do not move back by themselves. You know very well that in your own bedroom or your own study, if you simply live in it and leave it as it is, it will get more and more untidy. It takes effort and intelligence regularly to tidy it up and to bring it to order. It will never order itself. If a hurricane was to blow through Crieff Hydro now, it would knock it down. Now, for however long that hurricane blew, it would never reassemble Crieff Hydro, would it? That's the second law of thermodynamics. Now, there's order in a book, like this, which is the Church Hymnary. It's a bad example. Yes. This book, here's a book. You see, now, the order of the book is, of course, the letters and words from which it's all composed. Now, if I was to jumble up the words in this book, or the letters in a word, it would make no sense, it would have no meaning, it would convey no information. The letters and order and words have to be in exact order for it to mean anything at all. And so we have the order of information in letters and language, in the DNA code, and in the fundamental levels of existence. Now the second law of thermodynamics says that things move from a state of order to disorder by themselves, without outside intelligent intervention. That's how everything goes. And I believe this is one of the most powerful arguments against atheism. For where did the order come from in the beginning, if things always move towards disorder? Now some of you who know more about this subject will be aware of the work of Ilya Prigogine, if I'm pronouncing his name rightly. And he has shown in his book Order Out of Chaos that in certain in certain places you can have an increase in order without intelligent intervention. If you want to, I've written a little bit about this in my booklet. In fact, his work is on our side, not against it, but I don't want to go into too much technical detail now. But however one considers a local increase in order, there's always an overall decrease in order. Some people try and get round this problem of the second law of thermodynamics by saying that there's only a local increase in order on the planet Earth in this part of the universe. But this is no answer to the problem for the atheist, because the whole universe is very, very highly ordered. Every single atom is a highly complex, finely tuned thing. Where did that order come from? Right, now let me come to this question: what is the universe and how did it begin? This is cosmology. My brother is a professional cosmologist. He works as an astronomer in Cambridge in Australia and America. Now, where did the universe come from is the big cosmological question of this century. Now, if you're a scientific creationist, you know what I mean by that. You'll say that God created the stars as they are. He put them in their places. He did this about 10,000 years ago. Now, I'm not disagreeing with that. I don't disagree with that. It may well be just like that. And if it turns out that that's exactly how it is, I won't be a bit surprised. But let me describe what the more conventional astronomer thinks of the universe. And the most significant conclusion that cosmology has come to in the past decades is that the universe is not infinite. It has not always existed. The stars and the galaxies, you know what a galaxy is, a collection of several million stars. The stars and the galaxies have not always been there. The universe began. Now that in itself poses a religious question. How did nothing change into something without a creator? Now, the evidence that it had a beginning is this. I'll just make two very simple points. The stars are still burning. Now, fires don't burn forever. Fuel runs out. Indeed, the fuel that burns is burning in our own sun and all the stars will burn out one day. The stars are still burning. Therefore, they have not always been there. That's an obvious point. Secondly, another obvious point is that the stars have not collapsed into one another under the force of gravity. You know, the force of gravity acts throughout the universe. The stars are all very massive. You would expect then that gradually they would come closer and closer together, being pulled by their own force of gravity. They're still far apart, therefore they can't have been there forever. Now, Einstein was very puzzled by this, and he proposed that there must be an anti-gravity force that keeps the stars apart. But, if I may dare to say so, he was proved wrong. There is no such anti-gravity force. So, are the galaxies of stars in the process of collapsing now? The answer is no, they're not collapsing in upon one another now. Hubble, an astronomer earlier in this century, showed that the galaxies are actually moving away from one another. Not with an anti-gravity force pushing them away. He discovered that the further away a galaxy is from another galaxy, the faster they are moving away from one another. In other words, they are moving away from one another in an explosion. And that means that if we go back in time, they must have been a lot nearer to one another. And a very long time ago, we're all together in a singularity of infinite density, which exploded. And that is what is called commonly the Big Bang. Now, gravity is slowing down the expansion of the universe, but it is still expanding, or so orthodox cosmology believes. And it's believed that the Big Bang was approximately 10,000 million years ago. The Big Bang was a big bang of electromagnetic radiation, or light, which later condensed into the galaxies and stars which we know today. I notice that in the beginning of Genesis we read, "Let there be light," before the sun and the stars. Just a thought. Now, if the Big Bang is true, it means that there should be an echo of this Big Bang even today, in the form of low temperature background radiation spread evenly throughout space. And this was discovered in the 1950s accidentally by two American telecommunications experts. So conventional cosmology and astronomy has to come to terms with a genesis, and therefore a creator. Now, there are various ways of getting round this problem if you don't want to believe in a creator. And I'm just going to mention four of them that are commonly used. Some say that the universe is oscillating. That is, it's expanding from the Big Bang. It gradually slows down, and then it will collapse again, all into what is called the Big Crunch. That's not my word, that is the word that's used, which will then explode again and collapse in a series of expansions and contractions. However, the problem with this is that it now seems, from what we know about the universe, that it's very, very unlikely that the universe will ever collapse. The force of gravity is not great enough, the mass is not enough in the universe for that to happen. And even if the oscillating model is true, it could not be an infinite series of oscillations. So you still have to have a beginning. I haven't time at the moment to explain why it couldn't be infinite, but if you want to know, read Steven Weinberg's book, The First 3 Minutes. He's a Nobel Prize winner of physics in the United States. Secondly, people who don't want to believe in God say that the universe could be a mere bubble from another more fundamental universe which is in a different space-time framework. My answer to this is that there can't be in principle any evidence for or against there being another universe in a different space-time framework. And in any case, it would only push the problem one stage further back, because you'd have to ask the question, where did that universe come from? Thirdly, there's the argument used by Stephen Hawking, you know, the mathematician, astronomer, physicist with motor neuron disease. You occasionally see him on the television speaking through a computer. He says in his book, which I have here, A Brief History of Time, which I've only just read, actually. By the way, this book is the best introduction to the new physics, although I don't agree with everything in it. It's an odd book, really, because he refers to God throughout the book as if there was a creator. And yet in one of his chapters, he tries to argue against there being a need for a God. and yet he uses God throughout. He's obviously wrestling with this in his own mind, as are other physicists. Anyway, Stephen Hawking, in his argument to try and do away with the need for God, says that although the universe had a beginning in real time, it didn't have a beginning in what he calls imaginary time. Now, and he also invents a concept called inflation, which is not what you mean by inflation, or I normally mean by it, but it means the expansion rate of the universe actually increased rather than decreased at the beginning, which to me seems impossible. Anyway, I'm probably getting a bit too technical there, but I just thought I ought to mention that. And then fourthly, quantum theory, that's the science of the tiny things from which everything is made. Quantum theory predicts that material existence can come into existence in a vacuum. That seems very bizarre to us. However, this is what I'm saying, this is not self-creation from nothing, because what it really is saying is that the non-material is creating the material. The theories on the origin of the universe may change. Even the theory of the Big Bang may become outdated. I wouldn't know. But what is sure is this, and I don't believe this will ever change in scientific orthodoxy, the universe is finite and it began. The most sensible statement ever written about the origin of the universe is this: in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Let me just say something about the fine-tuning of the universe. Sir Bernard Lovell calculated with that expansion rate of the explosion from the Big Bang, if that expansion rate had varied by one part in 1,000,000,000,000, in other words, if it expanded a tiny little bit faster than it is expanding, the universe would be all gas and there would be no solid existence. There would be no stars and therefore no planets, no Earth. No solid existence at all. If its expansion rate had been less by one part in 1,000,000,000,000, it would have all collapsed in upon itself under the force of its own gravity, and the universe would have simply been a series of black holes. And there would have been no planets and no stars, no sun. Paul Davis, who's professor of theoretical physics at Newcastle, who's written the book God and the New Physics, he also is not a Christian, but he's written a book called God and the New Physics. You can see when you read his book that he's wrestling with this belief and unbelief in God. He does not want to believe in God, but he admits he's almost forced to in his book. And he says that the fine-tuning of the universe is like a man shooting a gun in a random direction and accidentally hitting a postage stamp positioned on the other side of the universe. That's the fine tuning. So who tuned the initial state of the universe so finely and so exactly? All this puts a nail in the coffin of atheism and pantheism, I believe. However, even without a knowledge of the things I've been talking about this morning, there is still no excuse at all for atheism. The fool says in his heart, "There is no God," is truer today than ever it was. What's the time? 10:55. Now I want to move on to more significant deep truths about nature. Perhaps I ought to just... Well, I'll go on a little bit longer. Perhaps then we can leave questions at the end of the next session. I want to move on to a very significant deep truths about nature. First of all, this is from Einstein, light is the most fundamental constituent of the universe, even more fundamental than space and time. In Isaac Newton's physics, space and time were just great containers for objects and events. So according to this view, and I suppose it's the ordinary view of the ordinary man in the street today, even before the universe existed, there would be infinite empty space and infinite empty time. But this view is now outdated. And what we get from Einstein's theories of relativity is that light itself makes space and time. And this is the real reason why nothing can go faster than light. You know that light travels at 186,000 miles per second. That's about 7.5 times round the world in 1 second. That's how fast it goes. And you may also have heard that there is no such thing as a greater speed than light. It's impossible for anything to go faster than light. And that may puzzle you as to why that should be. Well, the reason is that it's light that makes space and time. Light is not so much a thing moving in space and time, like a planet moves in space and time, like a car or a snooker ball moves in space and time, but light, in fact, makes space and time. Space and time are not the containers of nature. It's not as if there is a great infinite container called space in which various objects are placed. But space and time are part of nature itself. And therefore, as Augustine believed, part of the created order based on light. And the special theory of relativity, which was Einstein's first theory of relativity, tells us that time is not an absolute. Although all your watches are ticking at the moment to say that it's 11 o'clock, I can hear it all round, that means, you see, that for you and for me, our times are the same. If our watches are accurate, that means that wherever you are, whenever your watch goes peep, mine will go peep at the same moment, wherever we are. That's only because we are not moving at great speeds at relative to one another. If you and I were moving at great speeds relative to one another, speeds approaching the speed of light, I'm not talking about the speed in a Concorde or anything that we can do on this earth or even in our space program, but if you and I were moving at tremendous speeds relative to one another, our watches would not peep at the same time. Indeed, the example is given of two twins. This is in theory, it can't be done in practice. Two twins. One stays on the Earth, one travels into space on a spaceship. A spaceship accelerating towards the speed of light for, say, a year. Then the spaceship begins to slow down for another year from the speed of light till it stops. Then it begins its return journey, accelerates again up towards the speed of light, and then begins to slow down until it reaches back to the Earth. That's 4 years. So the spaceman will have arrived back on the Earth 4 years older than when he left. But his twin will have been dead and gone, and his children will have grown up and died, and their children will have grown up and died a long time before when he returns to Earth. That's the special theory of relativity, that time is not an absolute. It can be transcended in that way, because light is fundamental to time. Now, the general theory of relativity says that space is not an absolute. The space itself can be bent or curved by massive objects. Now, this is, I believe, highly significant for our theology. And I'm really quite orthodox in my theology, don't worry. Now, I think I should just finish there and come back and speak next time, in half an hour or whenever it is, about other things to do with this, about quantum theory, and I'll try and put it as simply as I can, and then relate that to such beliefs as determinism, the way of knowing God, the doctrine of the Trinity, the fall, the incarnation, the atonement, the ascension, the second coming, and the interpretation of the Bible. What are the reasons for the laws of nature? Or more simply, what is everything made of? Well, you may know that a molecule is the smallest part of any substance that can exist in normal room temperature. So if I had a piece of chalk and I broke it up, it would still be a piece of chalk. And I broke it up more and more and more, it would still be a piece of chalk. Even if I got tiny little bits of chalk on my finger so that you could hardly see them, it would still be chalk. And I'd be breaking it up more and more and more. I could do that, and the smallest bit of chalk that could possibly exist by what is the molecule made of? Well, it's made of atoms. Atoms of chalk. Now, what makes one atom, say of iron, different from another atom, say of oxygen? Well, what makes one atom different from another is the number of electrons, protons, and other wave particles from which the atom is made. All right, so what is the electron made of? Now, I can ask a similar series of questions about the reasons for the laws of nature. Why does a substance, such as iron, or oxygen, behave as it does? Well, it behaves as it does because of its molecular structure, the molecules from which it's made. But why do the molecules behave as they do? Well, they behave as they do because of the atoms from which they are made. And why do the atoms behave as they do? Well, they do so because of the number of electrons and protons, etc., from which they are made. But why do the electrons, etc., behave as they do? You see the series of questions going on and on. Now, there are two alternatives. Firstly, either science can go on forever and ever, deeper and deeper, getting into the smaller and smaller, so that it be an infinite process, going on always to find out what makes this behave as it does because it's made of this, but why does that behave as it does because it's made of this? And if that's an infinite process, science will never be able to answer the ultimate question as to what is the reason for the laws of nature, because it will never get there. Another alternative is this, that science will reach what it knows to be the most fundamental building block, so that now there is nothing smaller at all. There is no such thing as breaking up this particular building block. It's not made of anything. This is it. This is the fundamental thing. But then it still won't be able to answer the question, why does it behave as it does? Because there will be nothing smaller by which to explain it. Do you see what I mean? So in either case, there will be no way of knowing from nature the reasons for the laws of nature. Science, in principle, will never be able to answer that ultimate question. In other words, reductionism fails. The belief that we can explain everything by analysing its constituent parts fails. Reductionism fails. Now, what is the case? Is it that science will go on and on and on forever, ever getting smaller and smaller and smaller, the molecule to the atom to the electron to whatever makes that up, to whatever makes that up? Or will it come to a stop and say, right, we have now reached the ultimate building block? Well, I believe it will be the latter. Indeed, I believe it is the latter, and we've already got there. Why do we believe that electrons are the smallest thing beyond which we cannot go in principle. It is because, as I said earlier, they have been discovered to be not things at all. You may know there's been a dispute in science as to whether electrons are waves or particles. Now let me explain that for a minute. What is a wave? A wave is not a thing, it's a movement in a medium. So you can have a wave in the sea. You can have a wave in a piece of string, or an elastic band, or in the air. It's got to be in a medium. So, if an electron is a wave, it's a wave in what medium? Physicists say it's a wave of information. That involves language, as I've said. But in what medium? Well, let's say it's a particle then. But then we're forced to ask that question, it's a particle made of what? And you see, when we get to the level of the electron, we're getting to the edge of the material and the non-material. If I dare say so, the natural and the supernatural, or that which is beyond nature. Electrons and other fundamental wave particles are not things. Now, what do I mean when I say something is not a thing? That's a contradiction, isn't it? Well, I mean it's not a thing like other material objects. A thing is always in a particular time and space. For example, this thing here, called Howard Taylor, is in Creef Hydro, that's where he is in space, and the time is January the 9th and 10th. The moon is in such and such a place in space at such and such a time. Everything can be defined by the place it is and at certain time. But electrons are not bound by space and time like that. That's why they can't be pictured. You may have heard of EPR, which stands for Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen. Now, those three physicists predicted earlier this century, from quantum theory, that if you have two electrons coming from the same source and moving away from one another in space, whatever happens to this electron will affect that electron, even if they are millions of miles apart and there is no way in which they can communicate across space and time with one another. And that has been proved by experiment. Changing the spin in one affects the spin in the other, even though they can't communicate with one another. And this has led quantum theory to believe that, in fact, although in space and time they may be a million miles apart, they may be millions of miles apart, they are still bound together as in relationship with one another. There are no such thing as little particles floating around in the universe. The fundamental building blocks of nature are not little particles that are floating around. And this is an important thing I want to say now. At the fundamental levels of existence, there is no existence at all without relationship. And these relationships transcend the bounds of space and time. All things, living and non-living, are composed of these, and I'm quoting the physicist now, it's not a word I would use, all things living and non-living are composed of these ghostly entities. That's Paul Davis's term. Now you can see how pantheism and the New Age can indeed does use these discoveries. Indeed, pagans have said science is discovering what we've always believed. It has two errors. I just mentioned these. First of all, it denies creation and creator, that's the pagan view, which, as I hope I've shown, is you cannot deny creation and creator. And secondly, paganism and pantheism denies individuality. We're all part of the divine soup. Now, quantum theory says there is individuality, but that individuality is upheld in relationship. Do you see the difference? You see that the New Age science would try to deny individuality and say we're all part of the same spiritual thing. The quantum theory, in fact, says there is individuality, though it's upheld in relationship. Pantheism denies real individuality, or at least teaches that salvation is to lose one's individuality. And that is the purpose of some of these yoga techniques and meditation techniques that are used from the East. The discoveries of quantum theory are in greater harmony with the biblical statements such as in him we live and move and have our being, and all things are upheld by the word of his power. And there I think I will finish.